So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review me.
Rock. Considering the beating you took at the hands of Kurt Angle on SmackDown this past Thursday night, are you ready to meet?
Michael Cole, listen, listen. Tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. Kurt Angle, the countdown, and your reign as WWF champion is over.
It's Review Away, John Pollock and Wei Ting with us for another week. Wei, thank you for joining us this week. I know you are in the midst of a very busy travel week. I'm so glad you could set aside some time.
I'm back.
You are back.
I'm back.
I was very concerned after Sunday. You know, your signs have become the new RKO out of nowhere in the wrestling industry. They're just taking off, and then you no-showed Raw. I was like, uh-oh, his head's just gotten a little too big for us. He's just moved on. He's above the show, but you are back. You are here keeping your feet firmly on the ground, and we thank you for it.
Okay. Yes. Well,
listen, I understand the role here, okay? I'm Paul Schaefer, and you're David Letterman.
No.
And I'm happy.
No, listen, I mean, that was really cool on the weekend. I mean, Jesus, like, I couldn't believe it. I thought that was crazy, like two times in a week. But you guys don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah, you do.
No, you don't. Because if you keep doing it, this fucking asshole sitting next to me is just going to mock me every single time.
Do you know what our listeners are thinking right now? They are buying tickets right now. I think you are driving up attendance at WWE and all of these televised events. And me, being the intrepid journalist that I am, I can confirm there are more coming.
Wow. Okay, yeah. Is that so?
Yes.
Well, I hope some of you out there are planning a reverse side to the signs with maybe some reference to, Mr. Polak here.
No. I just want Way signs. If I see a Way sign, I'm going to fly to your city and shake your hand.
Because John just, like, he won't stop. He will not stop mocking. Mocking. Look at this.
This
grin.
Is great viral marketing for our podcast, okay? Yeah. To get your name out there. You know how many people are saying, what the fuck is a Wei Ting? Is this guy waiting for something? They're so confused, and I love it.
Clearly, I could only imagine the confusion. And, like, man.
You know, it should be Wei Ting with a question mark at the end. That should be it. With the bottom of the question mark being your face.
No, you don't have to. But yeah, it could be like almost like one of those, why are we here? Why? What are we waiting for in life in general? That could be the question.
It's like Jennifer Lopez asks right off the top.
But I mean, on Sunday during the kickoff, that sign was just like dead center. Like in every.
Dude, these fans, they block very, very effectively for television.
Yeah, it's. I suppose. I mean, you guys have great ability to. I mean, that and plus the one from last Monday where they were just like right.
I wonder how fluent our listeners are because they get the best seats.
Yeah.
Like, these aren't cheap seats.
They get great seats. And I could only imagine, somebody in the control room just wondering, what the fuck is that? You know, what are all these people waiting for?
Like, well, I believe the Grapple Kingdom sign got confiscated.
Oh, it did?
Because the guy went on our message board, and I went to clarify, and I haven't heard back from him, but he said he was told that he can't use the sign to promote a future event. And I asked him, I'm like, was it confiscated? It didn't get back to me, but it sounded like they took it away, and he was explaining that you cannot promote events on your signs. So that is awesome. Because you know that Grapple Kingdom really going to take a dent into that WrestleMania revenue coming to San Jose's way in a couple of weeks.
It's not even a thing that, like, it's just a... I've always thought it was just a joke, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's one of those jokes where suddenly there's like expectation and thus pressure.
Court has apparently...
More on you two than me. I'm just a bystander.
Court apparently has been training his ass off. Now, should I be a little concerned?
I don't know.
What's his game? Is he a top...
Listen,
game?
Wait. I'm not in the gym with Court, but I am in the gym with you. And I'm just going to say, like, your game is pretty tight right now.
No.
Collar choking the shit out of me.
No, I don't really
teaching
do
me
anything.
Double leg. Your double leg, I saw it evolve over the course of 30 minutes. And my God, I love training with Wei. I'm gonna go on a tangent here. This guy is so fun to train with because he will simplify things to me in the most basic of pro wrestling ways. We're drilling arm bars. You also have to have your thumb up. And he explains to me, don't watch Alberto Del Rio. He would never put his thumb up. That's why the guy always lost.
No, I didn't say that.
That's exactly what you said.
No, I said...
And I watched for it. I've been watching on Lucha Underground. You're right. Guy like doesn't put any focus on the thumb.
It's not. I didn't explain because that's why he loses. It's so he doesn't hurt his opponents.
Doesn't win with the arm bar.
Well, it's so he doesn't hurt his opponents.
Well,
primarily. Yeah.
I want some realism from Alberto El Patron.
But we're also drilling double legs. And, like, I think I was having trouble. I mean, for me, it's great drilling with you, John, because for me, it's like a lot of it's...
I'm your lump of clay.
No. A lot of it's review for me. And they always say that, you know, anytime you teach something, no matter what it is, you end up learning it better yourself.
I agree.
So, I mean, I'm basically using you as a chance to learn better jiu-jitsu for myself. But we're drilling double legs, and it's something I want to work on a lot. And I was having trouble explaining, you know, the momentum that you need to put forward. And then I just thought, like Roman Reigns, do it.
Like, oh, of course. Spear.
And then Pollock just starts cocking his fist before he attempts double legs.
People in the gym just look at these two fools.
Idiots. Yeah, I know. Yeah, but, I mean, it's a lot of fun. I'm hoping maybe we can get you on the undercard.
Oh, we'll see.
Who else is there?
I don't know.
Huh?
Let's not make any more promises. We don't even know if we can... we got to keep the main event intact. This is like promising Cain Velasquez.
I mean, I haven't even wanted to... I've never even wanted to address any of these Grapple Kingdom rumors, but I feel
there's no
like
contract signed.
Nothing yet.
You are like... It's Pacquiao Mayweather pre-last weekend.
You still don't know if it's... I personally, from my standpoint, I don't even know if it's going to happen. I don't know. I'm going to have to...
Did you use up all your dates? Do we have no dates left on you?
Well,
after WrestleMania,
all I can say, maybe we should be promoting a face-to-face confrontation.
Oh, I see.
And then
you would have to be the one though that is challenged, and you to the face-to-face confrontation, you have to make the elaborate video accepting.
I'm Sting.
You need to be
like my namesake.
Yes,
I was supposed
so
to.
That makes Court Hunter.
Yes. Oh, man, he'd love that.
It's great.
So
comes out in like a leather his leather jean jacket.
Yeah. So Court really thinks this is happening. From my standpoint, I don't even know where I don't even know what's going on. It was this gi, no gi. I don't even know where we would do it. And I don't even know if I want to do it, quite frankly. I'd never agreed to anything. I didn't. I just, you know, all of a sudden you guys start talking about it on Byron Pollock, and then I get sucked in. What is this? It's not fair.
Listen, as the go-between, there are logistical issues, and we'll see. Grapple Kingdom right now
is up in the air.
It's it's a twinkle in the collective eye of our listeners right now, and we will see what can happen over the next 5 weeks. We'll see what the build is like. I know you're ready. I know you're in shape.
I'm not. I'm really not in shape at all.
No, you're in pretty good shape.
No, I'm not in shape. And I think you should talk. Like, John makes it seem like I'm some type of like black belt whiz on this show. And that is
I promote you. Okay, I'm your advocate.
Yeah, that is the farthest thing from reality. Like, I'm very much a beginner. Court's been training like twice as long as
you're a blue belt, and he's a blue belt.
Court is a high level blue belt. And he's also like 100 pounds more than me, 200 pounds more than me.
Did you not just watch Brandon Thatch and Benson Henderson? Yeah, he's going to have some power early on, but I'm sure there's going to be some tentativeness. And then you take him into those deep waters.
Well,
I think there's money to be made on Wei Ting.
I don't.
He might come in. He might open up. The line may favor Court.
I think it absolutely favors Court. I'm definitely the underdog here.
We'll get Judo Gene LaBelle to come in and officiate this in nearby Los Angeles. He can make the trip up, San Jose.
I'm just excited to hear you call your play-by-play.
Oh, that's a different story. We haven't made any agreements.
Oh,
on
we
that.
Haven't signed you yet.
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, what would it take to sign you on? Kingdom.
I think we could do better. I think we could do better.
Well, who?
Well, we'll see what happens.
All right. You and Conan on commentary would be a dream.
I don't know if that one will happen either.
Okay.
It would magically take a lot of people to be all in the same place at once.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Maybe you and Cain Velasquez.
Maybe, yeah.
He'll be in San Jose.
That's true. He would be there. What do you want to chat about? No Way Out?
I think so.
Yeah. 2001. I can't remember why we chose this. I think someone requested it.
I believe so.
This was a Las Vegas card. My goodness, I was going back and looking at this. This show did 590,000 buys.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an amazing figure when you talk about how, oh, the February show, it's so hard because it's right before WrestleMania. I was like, no, the product was hot at the time, and this show did more buys in 2001 than WrestleMania would do in 2003.
Yikes. Wow.
Now, granted, that was a down year for WrestleMania, but still.
How old does WrestleMania, I mean, not now. I don't think you can. Well, actually, now. I'm curious. How well did WrestleMania do last year?
Well, to put it in perspective, I mean, this was 2001 where international buys were not what they would eventually grow into.
Okay.
But, for instance, like WrestleMania, the next, coming up the following month, did just over 1 million buys. And since that time, outside of that 2003 show, that's been about the level. I mean, the high point being 2007 and the 2012 show that did quite above that million figure. But that's what you're kind of looking at worldwide. Cool. So looking at this 590 figure, that's primarily a domestic number, which is an incredible statistic.
Hmm.
I mean, you'll typically have WrestleMania pre-network was doing in the, 600, 625,000 domestic range. So this was a hot, hot product. And there is a point that I'm trying to make here, being that when Steve Austin came back from his neck injury after being out for most of 2000, I mean, business was very, very good for his comeback. His first appearance was at the Unforgiven pay-per-view in September, which did a very good number. His first match back against Rikishi, the infamous Rikishi promo, which I just hope makes it into that Hall of Fame video.
Oh,
that has
guaranteed.
To be in the video. Guaranteed. That's his most famous line of his entire career.
Yeah.
That did a gigantic number for a No Mercy event in October. And then you'll remember this feud with Triple H featuring the epic destruction of Triple H in a car and a forklift,
mm-hmm.
which should have murdered Triple H, and murder being a three-week recovery.
He's a resilient.
That was right when that Unbreakable movie came out with Samuel L. Jackson. Do you remember that? Was it called Unbreakable?
I don't remember.
It was where nothing could kill him. That was the big joke, was Triple H is now playing this character. Anyway, that's the whole point of No Way Out, that we're trying to give some context to. Triple H and Steve Austin, which really did feel like the main event of this show, even though it was midway through the show.
I'll say, especially in hindsight, where, I mean, that this Rock and Angle match was also very good, but really the gem and the reason why anybody would watch the show again would be that Three Stages of Hell match between those two. What exactly had happened at the Rumble that year?
At the Rumble, you had Triple H and Kurt Angle in the title match, and then Steve Austin won the Royal Rumble, including The Rock being in the Royal Rumble, but then The Rock won a number one contenders match on SmackDown to get the title shot a month earlier to get to WrestleMania.
It's always been the weird thing. You need some title ramification for the February show, but you have the Rumble, so what do you do?
Yeah, I think it's especially tougher to digest when you have the guy that gets the title match at that February show had the opportunity in the Royal Rumble, and he failed.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he would end up headlining WrestleMania as the champion. Anyway, business will look back and say that things were just fine and people were accepting of it. But we start off the show, and you know what? The WWF learned a valuable lesson here at No Way Out. Don't go out and buy a popular song for use. Make your own ripoff version. So we got like a Jim Johnson remix of Machine Head.
Oh, okay. By Bush?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize.
That's basically the...
Didn't notice. All that stuff sounds the same, so...
Yeah, so why pay a lot of money for something you can duplicate and...
I suppose.
Pretty much sounds like the instrumental version of.
Yeah.
The opening video featured Kurt Angle, your WWF champion going into this show, making the threat of all threats to The Rock that he's going to No Way Out to shut that fat mouth.
Ouch.
Plop down your $30 and that fat mouth is going to be shut by Kurt Angle. This show was sponsored by Weeder Results. Big supplement.
Oh.
So people getting jacked on Weeder.
Mm-hmm.
Just in time for WrestleMania season. The announcers for the night were Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler. This would be 2 days before Jerry Lawler would walk out when his wife, the Cat, who was very much featured on this pay-per-view, was told, we really don't have much for you, and we're going to fire you. And it was believed that there was some attitude issues with the Cat and maybe some personal issues with China, and the Cat was going to be let go. And Jerry Lawler walked out with her, and that led to Paul Heyman coming on as the announcer a week after this show. So this would be Jerry Lawler's last pay-per-view for quite a while until he would return at the end of the year. Match number one was for the Hardcore Championship. Raven defending the title against the Big Show. And Big Show billed at 7'2". And as he comes out to the ring, he is attacked by this masked ninja.
Female ninja.
Female masked ninja.
Like a female Black Scorpion.
I had zero recall of this character. I had to look it up.
Who was it?
This was the original Tori.
Working with Raven?
Yes, and she would stay on television for a couple more weeks after this, and then they never went anywhere with it, and she was gone.
She was gone, yeah.
So one of those small bit character roles that exist from time to time. There were weapons spread out all over the ring, and as they're having the match, in runs a popcorn vendor dressed as Michael Hayes, but in fact it is Crash Holly, who delivers the acid drop to Raven.
He wasn't dressed as Michael Hayes.
He had the wig on. He had the hat.
He wasn't specifically dressed as Michael Hayes.
No, he was supposed to.
No.
That's who I thought it was.
If anything,
skinny Michael Hayes.
Well, nobody knows what Michael Hayes even looks like at that point.
Oh, of course they do.
He's not as recognizable of a character for somebody. He was just a generic popcorn vendor. If anything, he looked like, remember Tony Little? The infomercial dude?
Yes.
He looked just like
skinny
that.
Skinny Tony Little.
Yeah.
Also, skinnier Michael Hayes.
No,
PS
not,
for
not
pretty
at
skinny.
All.
Crash attacks him, Raven. Then the final cut is hit by the Big Show to Raven when Steve Blackman and then Hardcore Holly runs in. This was during the whole 24/7 period, the illustrious history of the Hardcore title. Then Billy Gunn runs in. He hits a Famouser and he pins Raven for the title at about 2.5 minutes. Then there's a top rope leg drop from Hardcore Holly as Blackman holds up Billy Gunn. Show then sends them out, and Raven sneaks a pinfall on the fallen Billy Gunn to regain the title. Raven's ninja woman, as Jim Ross describes her, returns and gets attacked by Molly Holly, who just briskly follows behind her to the ring, just waiting to attack her. Then Raven attacks Big Show with trash can shots. There's a choke slam to Raven onto the trash can, and Big Show pins Raven at 4 minutes and 19 seconds. And afterwards, Big Show fights off Billy Gunn. A tease, a hint of what would be to come later that year of the epic Shoguns tag team of Show and Billy Gunn. So Big Show wins the Hardcore title, and it would be a big night for the Big Show, who would make an appearance later on for God knows what reason.
Yeah. I can't say I recall any of these shopping cart plunder matches surrounding the Hardcore title and then 24/7 rule at this time. I really just saw them as excuses to...
The garbage can era.
Yeah, excuses to cram guys onto shows, excuses to get PAs to go out to whatever Home Hardware to do some shopping during the day to get them something to do. It's just, you know, they're awful. These are just terrible, terrible matches. And I feel the worst for the audio guy having to hit the music of every winner who wins the belt. Because, I mean, you know, this poor guy just, oh, it's Billy Gunn. Okay, I got to start this music. And then immediately stop it because the match is continuing. And then, oh, okay, and then Big Show wins. I got to hit that music and then stop. It's a lot of work. So I feel bad for him most of all.
Kurt Angle is arriving in a limo from earlier in the day, and he is interviewed by Kevin Kelly, who asks him about the title match tonight. Kurt Angle says he is doing super, and that Las Vegas has the highest percentage of losers in the country, and one more will be added to that list with The Rock tonight. I guess that's an unofficial survey, where people from other cities can be marked down as losers in the city. I guess this is just a general tourist-wide survey as well.
Okay.
Lillian Garcia is with Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero in the back. And they are asked if they can coexist tonight together in the four-way match for the Intercontinental title. Benoit says that one of them is going to leave with the title, and there is no proving that wrong.
Yeah.
A prelude to his prove me wrong tagline and also getting set for a match that would be definitive proof that that statement is wrong.
Yes. You know, you get to see here basically Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit on screen together, which I think are, you know, already conjures up a lot of memories. But
you just glossed over that random thought pretty seamlessly.
What do you mean?
I can't watch Chris Benoit ever speak without just everything that he says can somehow be twisted.
Yes, certainly. But my point, I think, was more so about, you know, the chance to. These two are very much peers. I mean, you know, not just in ring, but you can also compare the stages that they were at in terms of their in talking ability. And I think this was a perfect comparison between the two abilities. You have Eddie Guerrero, who just sounds so completely natural, and you had Chris Benoit, who you could really tell from hearing this was trying really, really hard to sound natural. And I don't think it really helps that some guys just aren't meant to talk in that type of script, in that type of tone. And I got the sense that they were kind of scripting him or trying to make him fit the mold of a traditional pro wrestler, which he shouldn't, he doesn't need to be. He should have always just been, you know, the strong, silent type to not really say anything at all. And I kind of see Roman Reigns in a similar mold.
Four-way Intercontinental title match. Chris Jericho defending the title against Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, and X-Pac. In one of X-Pac's last appearances with his old theme music, because we were right on the cusp of the introduction of a brand new faction led by X-Pac.
Yo, you dealing with the X-Factor.
I got everything I ever wanted, and I'll never get that back.
Yo.
Oh, I know you hate the X-Factor, but you ain't gotta look at me like that. I said you ain't gotta look at me.
X-Factor with Uncle Cracker.
My God.
One of the great...
That song again.
Theme songs.
You just wanted...
In WWF history.
You just had to work that in there, huh?
Hey, opponents need to know what they're dealing with.
So, you know, think about it for a second. You have a guy like X-Pac who already at this time, DX had was long gone. Triple H had moved past that. Billy Gunn was in the hardcore division. X-Pac
Road
here...
Dog had been fired.
Right, and X-Pac here, just, what do you do with this guy? He was already getting booed, and it was almost like he was like... you know, wanting people to boo him, because every time he'd throw one of those kicks, he'd stick his tongue out and do the ridiculous kung fu posing as if, like, he was like a little child after watching a kung fu movie. You know what I mean? And so whose bright idea was it to give this guy his own faction, this very lovable character that nobody seemed to like?
Well, it was is a new coat of paint for one Sean Waltman to put him with Just Incredible and Albert,
I guess.
And we would see the building blocks of this faction actually during this match. Now, four ways are typically one of the more difficult matches to put together. And you had four quality performers, I believe, in these ones. I
mean,
say what you will about Sean Waltman and his staleness as a character. Always was a great performer.
Absolutely.
And Benoit Guerrero would start off the match double-teaming Jericho. They were working together. Jericho went for the spinning heel kick that does not come close to hitting Eddie Guerrero. This also happened at the Fastlane show where Rusev delivered one of these to Cena. And God knows it happens almost any time Summer Rae tries a spin kick. This is just one of those moves where you just gotta lay it in there, like a shoulder during a double leg, where you just have to drive forward, because if you hesitate or the guy bumps too early, man, does it look stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes they're lucky in that like a camera cut can save it, but not always.
Benoit then sends Guerrero to the top, but as Eddie is climbing to the top, Benoit applies the crossface on X-Pac, making Guerrero look confused, thinking they were working together, and Jericho shoves Guerrero off the top. Guerrero then comes back with a frog splash to X-Pac, but Jericho then breaks the fall a few moments later. Then Benoit's going for the fall, and Eddie puts Jericho's foot on the rope, so it took all of 3 minutes for Benoit and Eddie's unbreakable alliance to splinter. Benoit hit a bridging German to Jericho, and then Guerrero breaks it. They then begin fighting. Jericho hits this double underhook backbreaker to Benoit. Then they traded these big chops, worked a several-minute sequence together, which was a lot of fun. Then there was a roll-through by Jericho into the walls of Jericho. Eddie comes in. Then he goes for the walls onto Eddie, does the same to X-Pac, can't get it. Justin Credible shows up, who had just recently debuted. Remember, this was about a month after ECW's last show, and was a... There were still a lot of ECW guys hoping against hope that ECW would somehow pull itself out of the fire and they would kind of get the nail in the coffin the following Monday when Heyman showed up. But X-Pac, incredible. They double superkick Benoit on the floor. There's a facebuster and lion salt delivered to Eddie, and X-Pac makes the save. Then he hits Jericho with a low blow and X-Factor. Just lots of spots hit and saves here for pinfall attempts. There's a top rope headbutt to Eddie, but then X-Pac delivers a spin kick to Benoit and then goes for a rolling back cradle, Jericho does, to X-Pac to steal the win at 12 minutes, 20 seconds. Jim Ross puts it over as an awesome match. Chris Benoit's theory is not true, as Chris Jericho keeps the title.
Proof.
The proof was in the pudding of Chris Jericho. I thought, you know, for a 12-minute, 20-second four-way match, I remember at the time there were a lot of big expectations for this match, just given who was in it, and kind of was a good match then, and kind of a good match to go back and watch now. I think if this happened on Raw today, people would be raving about this.
I thought it was just okay, and I think largely because of the expectations put forward, but I think, you know, the tornado rules here, there's just so much going on. It's kind of hard to follow any single storyline in the ring. I will say they did a decent job of keeping the focus on one area at a time for the most part. But, you know, the month prior, Benoit and Jericho had that great ladder match. And the month late after this, Benoit and Angle would have a fantastic match on their own. So I think the level was just so high at that point. This is really a match that you can forget about and not miss a thing.
Yeah, Benoit and Angle, if you remember, I mean, they were really two odd men out for WrestleMania that year, and it typically always happens. And especially Kurt Angle coming out of losing the title, that match between those two, which is pretty well remembered, that wasn't announced until the go-home show for WrestleMania. It was just, here are workhorses, we're going to throw them out with very little build, and the feud would happen after WrestleMania. Yeah. WrestleMania would start the feud.
Certainly, I think some build would have helped that match at all, but it was such a good dream match for the hardcore audience that I don't think you really needed anything. And you actually can foresee, you know, somebody like Daniel Bryan and Dolph Ziggler in a similar situation.
Or Sheamus.
God.
That is the tagline that I have coined.
Man.
Third time is the lucky charm for Daniel Bryan and Sheamus at WrestleMania.
Terrible.
Hunter is being taped up for his match, and we cut to William Regal, who is with Vince McMahon, William Regal being the commissioner at the time. Vince blames Regal for tonight's Trish Stratus versus Stephanie McMahon match, and explaining how Stephanie is his daughter and Trish is Vince's very good friend at the height of their creepy segments together.
Mm-hmm.
One of Vince's many angles involving women significantly younger than him. And we would get a video package afterwards featuring all of those highlights. Says he is confident that Regal will know what to do at the right time. And Vince walks off and Regal admits to himself he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't understand if Vince is implying help out his family or help out his chick.
Yeah. These are kind of funny. I think Vince is very funny in these little things.
Then we got the video on the Trish Stratus, Stephanie McMahon feud. This involved Linda being put into a sanitarium after Vince McMahon and his well-remembered "I want a divorce" line, which would be trumped by Linda's announcement of wanting a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was the affair between Vince McMahon and Trish Stratus, where we saw Trish grabbing Vince McMahon's ass, manure thrown onto Stephanie, and then the soundbite from Stephanie: "It's no secret you're a bitch, but tonight you'll be my bitch."
The word "bitch"
was in full force in 2001 vernacular for WWF writers.
Must have been used 30 times in this recap segment alone.
We cut to WWF New York, and for the first time ever, a fan in the crowd was more famous than the talent on the stage, as we saw Busta Rhymes with horrible seats way up in the back of WWF New York.
Mm-hmm.
Credit that they knew the guy was there and at least identified him. And then it was like just a slowing descent of star power as we cut to Test on the stage. And Ross says how he knows both women very well. Yes, he does. He was pegged to be a main event star attached to Stephanie when Triple H got the main event program, and Test was thrown into obscurity afterwards. Mm-hmm. So, yes, he knows them very well. Trish, who was his manager when she debuted and went on to be a much bigger star than either T or A.
His question when posed with the prediction for this match, he says, well, I guess we're going to find out who the biggest trash bag hoe of the WWF is.
Boy, couldn't even come up with his own diss. Had to take Jericho's.
Trash bag hoe.
That was always the Jericho line. Yeah, this was a Test at his finest speaking role. Stratus is in the back. Regal comes up to her and says, simply, "I don't have time for this. I have a bitch to slap." I should clarify, Trish said that, not Regal.
This is like, man, what great writing. What flawless writing in this 5 minutes. It should be nominated for best screenplay.
"I've got a bitch to slap."
Yeah, trash bag hoe.
And then they cut to Stephanie walking in the hall backstage. This was played up like this was WrestleMania a month early. There was a promo for Raw being the most popular show on cable TV, and if you don't get it, demand it. I imagine this was in response to the fact that when the WWF did move from USA to TNN, TNN was in slightly less homes, and I guess maybe a push on people to, if you don't get TNN on your cable package, demand it. This was followed by WWF The Music Volume 5 featuring the song "Pie" by The Rock. And if you bought the CD, the compact disc, you would get a custom internet browser of The Rock.
On an enhanced CD.
I'm so glad these ads remain in these network versions of the pay-per-view. Just so that you can take us back to 2001 trinkets that would be used as motivation to buy something, such as a custom internet browser.
Yeah, what would a Rock internet browser look like?
Probably, like, instead of the arrow, it would be the eyebrow to click on your icon, maybe.
Right. Instead of the back buttons, you'd have, like, horns. Like the bull horns.
Yeah, maybe when you click on an icon, there would be, like, an aroma where you're smelling what the icon is loading.
Okay. Actually, the arrows would instead be pies.
Of course. Or just their literal interpretation, if it's an 18-plus version of an internet browser.
That'd be weird. You think there's a private mode in or incognito mode in the Rock browser?
Yeah, you it blocks your IP, and then the sound effect comes up. It doesn't matter what your IP is.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Jesus Christ, you and I, we came along too late in wrestling history. We would have been a great asset to the marketing department, I feel. And then Trish Stratus and Stephanie McMahon would have their singles match. Let's go back and give this an honest appraisal of what the expectations were for this match.
Yeah.
Like, this was expected to be one of the worst matches in years on a WWF pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. Trish Stratus was not known for her in-ring ability by any stretch at this point. She had only been in the company a year. She was nowhere close to the performer she would grow into. And Stephanie McMahon, conversely, was an extremely limited performer. And that is why this match, I think, is maybe more well-remembered from this show than even the title match or the two out of three falls match, because this was a match that blew away expectations at the time because of the limited ability. This wasn't a match of the year.
I don't know about the two out of three falls, but
I think when most people go back to No Way Out, I think they remember this up there.
Maybe. Debatable, but okay.
Anyway, Lawler brings up Trish and the recent segments involving her having a bubble bath, a massage, and getting spanked as some of the standout moments.
So sure.
We talk about Dean Ambrose getting to TV and looking what he's got on his run sheet. Trish Stratus, it was probably like, Christ, what do they have next for me?
I'm sure she's just happy to be on TV.
This was before the dog barking as well, which would come the following week. Anyway, match begins. Trish is tossed to the floor. Stephanie is attacking her with forearms. Trish's tights get hiked up as JR notes that she has that Rikishi thing going on. They also had to battle numerous puppies chants, which this crowd...
Battle? I mean, it was pretty much encouraged at this time.
Well, the match coming up later was absolutely promised.
Yeah.
If one woman won. Trish attacks her with slaps, running bulldog, gets a two count. Lawler calls the bulldog the Trish dog, which is maybe a... hatching the idea that would come to television about a week later. Trish hits a DDT, gets another two count, chokes Stephanie in the corner. Then Stephanie flips her off the top, landing Trish on her back. And Stephanie runs her into the announce desk and dumps a conveniently placed pitcher of water onto Trish that was just there, I guess, to keep JR and Baller hydrated throughout the broadcast.
Yeah, I guess. And what was her thinking? How did she feel like this would... help her clinch the match. Maybe she thought she was going to give Trish a cold, slow her down.
Yeah. Lawler got so excited, yelling, wet t-shirt, wet t-shirt. Not, I guess, fully grasping the whole dynamic of a wet t-shirt on a woman and a black top really doesn't lend itself to Jerry's ultimate fantasy, I guess.
Okay. I mean, it's still kind of hot.
Trish jumps onto Stephanie and takes a power bomb. And then Stephanie pulls down the trunks of Trish, revealing a thong, and starts spanking Trish and starts tearing the shirt off. And this crowd became unglued at this.
Mm-hmm.
Regal then comes down to the ring and drops poor Jimmy Corderas and places Trish on top of Stephanie. But then he hesitates, thinking he has made the wrong act, and puts Stephanie's foot on the rope, saving her. Trish then slaps Regal. Regal goes to take Trish by the hand, but then wraps her arm around her own neck, dropping her, and places Stephanie on top, and Stephanie McMahon gets the pinfall at 8 minutes, 31 seconds. I give both of these women credit. I think this match was probably vigorously laid out and rehearsed ahead of time. They got the best they could out of each other. And this was at a time when women were sent out really as objects to a lot of these fans. I mean, that's how these women were presented at this time.
Yeah, they kind of still were in this match.
But they were trying to, I think...
They had a good match, no doubt. Absolutely. And by no means a technical marvel, but for a match between two non-wrestlers, they really managed to keep this crowd engaged and reactive the whole time, which, I think is more than you can say for a lot of matches that we see.
Then we had a promo for WrestleMania 17... essentially, all of these walks of life being joined by one unifying force, and that is WrestleMania, including mimes, farm workers, monks.
Oh, this was... I like this ad. This ad a lot. They made it seem like it was, like, a life-changing event, which maybe for that year, for some people, it was.
With the payoffs Rock and Austin got, I'm sure it was life-changing.
Yeah. But I can't believe this was like 14 years ago, this commercial. I think it still holds up.
This is this was before the whole campaign with Limp Bizkit and My Way for that same show. Vince approaches Regal in the back and asks, what is the matter with him? He is not happy about this result. And he yells at him, saying, this is going to result in the two of them in the ring tomorrow night on Raw, and he makes a tag match where it will be Regal and Stephanie against Vince and Trish in Phoenix the next night.
I thought these two were very funny here. Just basically Vince, you know, making it look like he, no matter what he did, he couldn't do the right thing.
There's a video on Austin and Hunter and their feud kicking off with the mystery car driver, which would originally be revealed as Rikishi, but the mastermind behind it, who put Rikishi up to it, being Triple H. So Austin responded by murdering Hunter on a live pay-per-view. And through the build-up to this match at No Way Out, there would be no physical contact as demanded by Vince McMahon, or else Steve Austin would lose his championship match at WrestleMania. So instead, in 2001, the babyface had an option. Besides this, he could stun Stephanie, which he did on television, and Triple H retaliated by attacking who for easy heat? Good old JR, and hits a pedigree to Jim Ross. Michael Cole refers to this as the most personal rivalry in WWF history. So after I've outlined all of this bad blood between the two, running a man over with a car, then dropping a man 40 feet in a forklift, makes this even more mind-boggling that these two would join together 2 months later.
Mm-hmm.
One of the truly great botches, I feel, in WWF history.
Yeah.
Michael Cole is with Austin. Michael Cole, in the most serious tone, asks him,
Stone Cold, are you ready to enter hell next?
Are you ready to enter hell next? Austin just says to himself, fuck this era, and walks off.
What a stupid question.
Are you ready to enter hell next?
Is that something you would ask a UFC fighter? Ready to fight?
There would be something novel about having interviewer like this on a UFC broadcast who just asks the, like, my guest at this time.
Imagine Rory McDonald.
He could be the interviewer.
Yes.
Are you ready to go to the utter depths of hell where Lucifer himself will take hold of your primal urges and destroy your opponent across the cage?
Okay, and let's say he was asking Anderson Silva.
Ooh, hell. Hell, bad place. Hell, hell, God, no hell.
Okay, that is number one. I don't give a shit what people think is the top ten. Anderson is number one. Rory cracks the top ten for sure.
I don't know how good Rory is. I'll say Anderson's the easiest one to do. There's some that take more. I think Anderson's the easiest one to do.
That is so good. Still waiting on your top ten list, everybody. Keep them coming.
Wow. We had Triple H and Steve Austin. Three stages of hell. Thunderous reaction for Steve Austin as he comes out. Once again, a month before they were going to turn this man. I have always looked at this turn as puzzling. I mean, certainly Austin felt that his character was getting a little stale. I mean, there was something to that at the time. It wasn't like Austin was crazy. But, I mean, God, I think that's a very anecdotal response to a guy that was doing massive business on pay-per-view, the most over babyface on this card. And this whole match was designed to, I mean, this was clearly in place where the idea was Austin's going to go into WrestleMania and he's going to need a top-level opponent coming out of WrestleMania, and that was going to be Triple H.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I really liked the idea of this where, everyone assumes Triple H, Steve Austin just runs through the guy in the February show. They did the opposite. Austin could afford to lose this and have a big program coming out of WrestleMania, whether that be Triple H as a babyface or a heel. They could have kept Austin as a babyface and had Hunter stay as a heel, his more effective role.
It was interesting, that booking, and I think it really relied on the quality of the match that these two would have to have in order to be able to sell that.
Match number one was just going to be a straight wrestling match, and the crowd is electric at the start of this match. Austin hits a Fez press close to the ropes and just gets dropped on them. Austin then runs the left arm of Triple H into the post repeatedly on the floor, and Hunter did such a great job throughout the rest of this match. Every time he would go for the pedigree, he would sell that arm. Throughout this match, this arm would be bothering him throughout. The crowd was into all of Austin's offense. Hunter got his boot up as Austin came off the turnbuckle, continued selling this arm. Then Hunter would clip the knee, wrapped it around the post, used a figure four. Austin would turn it over. Great selling from both here, and Austin using the knee brace to the face of Hunter. A stunner gets blocked by Hunter. Then he blocks it a second time and hits a reverse neck breaker. Hunter kicks Austin low, and Earl Hebner is just blind throughout this match. And Hunter comes off the turnbuckle into a kick and gets stunned by Austin, and Austin wins the first fall in about 12 minutes, 21 seconds. Pretty fast pace, and you know, typically you can sense when they're going super long. This pace was extremely fast, yeah, considering the amount of time they were scheduled to go.
Very fast from the get-go, and you can understand it because, you know, you basically had three matches to wrestle in the span of, I don't know, 40 minutes or however long they went. It was as if they just cut out, you know, the first 15 minutes of a 25-minute standard wrestling match here. And I thought it was very good. Austin just, he's so great at bringing that intensity and that really wild brawling style, but he's never sloppy. You know, you can think about a lot of other wrestlers who might kind of be able to exhibit that same intensity and that same kind of recklessness, but Austin is on point with all of his moves, all of his selling is on point. Everything he does is actually very technical. And, you know, 2001 Triple H was also fantastic. I mean, this whole run I think he had between 2000 and 2001 before the quad tear, he was just a great worker. I think he still is. There's a point there where he wasn't and fell in love with his body too much, but in this era, I thought he was just awesome.
Yeah, those Weider results.
That's it.
Yeah, Austin, his babyface fire was just something to watch back here. The second fall was a street fight. And Austin hits a vertical suplex to Hunter on the steel ramp twice, and they fight around the ring. And I really liked how the street fight immediately changed the whole dynamic of the match. Now we're going to go nuts. There was a monitor shot to Triple H. They fought into the crowd. They come back into the ring. Austin just lights him up with multiple chair shots.
I almost found this as almost a way of foreshadowing his WrestleMania 17 match with The Rock, where he shows that same level of desperation using weapons and ultimately
right down to the chair shots after the match. It was the identical spot.
And ultimately, even, you know, going as far as using Vince McMahon to help him win at any cost.
Yeah, and the crowd is just loving all of this offense from Austin. Austin then finds a barbed wire 2x4 that's just, you know, in case you ever need that under the ring.
It was underneath the announce desk, and the whole rest of the match, JR, Lawler asks why JR brought this here. And the weapon itself got a chant, got a big Foley chant.
Yeah, I mean, that was an over... The sledgehammer and the 2x4 with the barbed wire wrapped around were more over than a significant portion of the current roster.
Yeah, sure.
Austin starts bleeding from the forehead because Hunter cuts him off, and he attacks Austin with the 2x4. There's this horribly missed punch by Triple H that Austin sells by leaping back over the announce desk from maybe the biggest blunder of the entire match. This was botchamania bad.
What do you mean?
I mean, maybe it was just the force of the wind that sent Austin flying. Hunter goes for a pedigree onto the desk, but his arm is still being favored, and it allows Austin to back body drop him off the U.S. table onto the Spanish announce desk, and JR just picks up the intensity here. It's really evident where he can escalate the gears.
And I like that we're doing this show right after the NWA Chi-Town Rumble last week, where we saw a very different side of Jim Ross as a commentator. I mean, last week he was very much concerned with the play-by-play and treating it as a real sporting event. Here, the focus is more on creating a sense of panic and atmosphere.
This was life or death.
Yeah, and, you know, again, it's all done to really fit the style of the program. And I thought he was also great in this, but just in a different way.
Austin then cracks him with a beer can, and Hebner is getting in his way, which leads Austin to yell, "Get the fuck out of here," as he shoves Earl away. They go back into the ring. Hunter hits him with a ring bell and gets a two count. And what I liked about this was when he hit him with the ring bell and went for the cover, it might have been the second pinfall attempt throughout this entire thing. It was like they were not going for pinfalls over and over. These two wanted to murder each other. And it really added to this being a personal feud where it wasn't just getting a win over the guy. It was damaging them. Austin took a suplex onto the chair as Hunter is continually going for covers at this point. Blocks a pedigree, back body drops Hunter to the floor. Austin cracks him with a chair to the head on the floor, attacks him with steps. Now Triple H is also bleeding. Hunter tries to move the timekeeper's table and ends up dropping it on himself. Then he grabs the sledgehammer from under the announce desk, where Lawler accuses JR of hiding it for Hunter, and Ross calls Lawler a dumbass for this assertion. Hunter then blocks a stunner and clocks Austin with the sledgehammer to the face, hits a pedigree for the fall at 28 minutes and 10 seconds, as JR notes, for the second by God fall. All even with one fall to go, and that's the steel cage match.
Another very intense match, the second fall, and I just, you know, like, we get street fights so often as the first match of a feud so often these days, and they're just kind of throwaway matches. Here, I just thought the two matches followed each other really well, and the intensity really built from one to the next.
It was – I loved how they differentiated the falls and the strategy as well, and the street fight was as advertised. The third fall is the steel cage, complete with the steel cage theme music as the steel cage lowered. Hunter rakes the barbed wire into the face of Austin, who eventually stops it with a chair to Hunter's head and then uses the barbed wire bat. They're both beaten down. Austin is attacking him with strikes. Hunter is trying to climb out of the cage but cannot win that way, they explain. Hunter runs into the top of the cage, gets crotched and falls down, tosses Hunter off the top. Hunter blocks a stunner and hits the pedigree. Austin kicks out of the pedigree, which was not something that happened with any kind of regularity, so that was a very protected finish. Hunter then hits a chair shot to the head, which Austin wisely getting his hands up, and Austin counters a pedigree, catapults him into the cage. Then he hits the stunner, sells it big as he hits it, and Hunter kicks out of the stunner, and crowd really peaking at this point. They have a sledgehammer in hand with a barbed wire bat. They each hit one another, and both fall down, but Hunter lands on top of Austin and gets the pinfall at 39 minutes, 26 seconds, and a huge sell by Jim Ross, and says that he doesn't know if either one of these men will ever be the same after this match. This was just a tremendous 40-minute match by these two guys working at a pretty furious pace.
Yeah. I think seems like a daunting task, to be honest, when you're just presented with the challenge of having three matches within the span of 40 minutes and having them all, you know, tell a certain story. This last fall, you know, in terms of intensity, in a pace, it was slower than the previous two. It was largely, you know, mainly a wrestling match with a little less weapons and, you know, but the difference was that both men at this point in the third fall were so tired. And despite the slower pace, the drama is still there because it feels that like that much more of a struggle for both men to finally clinch that victory. I think this match is one of the best in both men's careers. And, you know, it happened to come at a time, in my opinion, when both men were sort of at their peak in terms of both in-ring ability and how over they were with their characters. So just really great energy throughout the whole thing. Really great story told throughout.
How long did it take you, Steve, when you had that layoff with the neck injury? You were out close to an entire year at that point. At what point were you kind of able to get your cardio back to that point prior to the injury? Was it a matter of weeks, months? What was that like for you coming back late 2000?
Well, I mean, it wasn't even – I wasn't even back in ring shape. I think do you remember when I wrestled Triple H in Vegas, I think, and the it was like that?
Yeah, the
cage match.
Yeah, you guys went
match.
About 40 minutes or so that night.
Yeah, and that was right after my I'd come back from the neck injury. So, actually, I was gassed in that match. I don't know if you can tell or not, but, I mean, I still wasn't in ring shape and actually blew a couple of high spots. But nonetheless, it was a hell of a match. I loved working with Triple H. Someone threw a beer over the cage at the end and hit him in the forehead with a full beer. But, you know, prior to coming into WWF when they first hired me, I was coming out of ECW, coming back from a tricep injury, and they put me in the ring with Savio Vega. It took me 2 months of working in the ring with Savio Vega every single night till I got in premier shape. And when you work with Savio Vega, who can absolutely go, he's the guy that got me back in shape. And once I got back in shape, if we jerked the curtain or if we were third or fourth on a card, there wasn't a match that could follow us. But that's what Savio Vega did to me, from a thing of shining him up, being able to get my heat, kick his ass, and then feed his comeback.
And I thought that this was laying out so much after WrestleMania, which is always a struggle coming out of WrestleMania. And they seem to have their program, and I just think it was a real blunder on their part. I mean, even overlook the Austin turn. The fact that Hunter was also aligned with Austin, they really dropped the ball with this.
Yep.
They had no real big opponents for Austin coming out as a heel. Hunter should have been turned at that point in time if they were going to go full ahead with your Austin heel turn, or the reverse. But this should have been a program that they went back to, and they didn't after.
Right, right. I mean, I could just kind of see the effect of, you know, Austin turning, creating a sort of a domino effect on a lot of things, and this was just maybe one of those. You can't blame them for really wanting to try something new. I feel like ultimately they could have done that, but probably the timing was just way too early.
Jerry Lawler then says that he needs to leave so we can all see the cat naked later tonight, and he leaves. The Right to Censor is in the back in a huddle, and then they cut to the cat putting a jacket on, as JR says,
"This is what they're fighting over, the right to nudity with the cat. She's dying to be naked here tonight and no way out."
Those are the stakes involved, Way.
Mm-hmm.
An exhibitionist at heart. And Taz comes out to call the rest of the show. This was right at the time that he had been calling Sunday Night Heat and was very much segueing his in-ring career to that of a broadcaster. And I think having a lot of faith in this guy to call the rest of this pay-per-view, including the main event. They didn't bring Jerry Lawler back for the title match. They kept Taz out there with Jim Ross. So clearly showing that this is a color commentator that they were going to be focusing on.
When did he take over SmackDown?
It would have been after this.
After.
Because Lawler was still calling SmackDown at this point, and I imagine Taz would have been inserted in there once Lawler walked out.
Right.
So Jerry Lawler vacating his seat both literally and figuratively in a span of a couple of days here for Taz. Steven Richards comes out with Ivory to take on Jerry Lawler, who is accompanied by the cat. The stipulations: if Jerry Lawler wins, he will allow his wife to be naked for this entire crowd. And if he loses, she must join the Right to Censor.
There's something like really
weird about a parent possibly taking a 10-year-old child to No Way Out and explaining the stipulations of this match.
Well, that, yeah, is weird. But I think just in storyline, something weird about, a 50-year-old man parading around his 20-something-year-old wife.
Girlfriend, parading
around her naked body. There's just something like creepy, like they're like these swingers that you would meet on a vacation in the Bahamas, and you know, it's like they're trying to ask you if you want to join in tonight. You know what I mean? That type of vibe, which is cool. Like if you're into that, but I think with Jerry Lawler, I don't know if I'd be into that.
I think Brian Mann said it best the other night on Twitter. Something tells me Jerry Lawler doesn't have a daughter. The Las Vegas Outlaws, who were one of the XFL teams, we didn't even mention that. This was February of 2001, just a few weeks after the launch of the XFL, so we were full into...
Wow, so much was happening.
This was a very insane period of time. You had ECW going out of business. You had WCW right on the brink of being sold. You had the XFL launching.
Mm-hmm.
This was a very... And building to the biggest WrestleMania up to that point in their history.
Yeah.
Returning to a stadium event. So a lot going on in this early part of 2001. The Las Vegas Outlaws cheerleaders were on Sunday Night Heat to do a dance routine and got stopped by the Right to Censor, who did not care for these cheerleaders. Lawler starts off the match with punches. Richards bails to the floor as Lawler then holds up Ivory, and Kat slaps her on the floor. Richards then gets the advantage and teases going for the Ho train and misses him. Lawler hits him with about 25 punches on the turnbuckle and then hits a bulldog for a two count. Giant chance of "We Want Puppies" by the crowd. Richards then gets a chair as Ivory is distracting Teddy Long, but there is a low blow to Richards, and then Lawler hits a DDT and then hits a second DDT. Richards then is able to get to the floor. He grabs the women's belt and misses with the belt shot. Then Ivory gets body slammed by Lawler. They get distracted with Ivory. Richards misses with another belt shot. So they were constantly teasing that Richards was going to win this match with some way of cheating, and Lawler would continually thwart all of these shenanigans on Richards' part. But then finally, the Cat comes in and grabs the women's title belt and misses Richards and ends up clocking Lawler. And Richards gets the pinfall at 5:34, and Ross alerts everyone there will be no nudity tonight, as the Cat is placed in a burlap sack and hoisted and taken to the back by Val Venus, where she is now a member of the Right to Censor.
Mm-hmm. And what actually happened? How did they explain her absence?
I can't even remember how they did explain it on TV, because if you remember, when Heyman first showed up, he basically said what happened with the Cat was gone and Jerry Lawler walked out with his girlfriend.
Do you find it odd that they would have let her go like at right now, right after, you know, doing this angle and right before WrestleMania?
Oh, it's very odd. I mean, the reason that they gave Lawler, that they just didn't have a whole lot of ideas for her, were ridiculous when you just kicked this off. And the idea was, you know, there was some talk at the time that China felt the Cat was getting too over in that babyface position. Who knows?
There was probably some issues there.
And it ultimately led with the Cat going. But, I mean, what would they have expected here? That Lawler wasn't going – he was just going to simply say, okay, cool, you're firing my wife – or my girlfriend. I keep saying wife. But anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Cat would end up leaving Jerry Lawler for another person. And Lawler would say, well, you know what? I don't have any problems now with the Cat not being in the company. I'll come back.
Yeah.
And he would be back in November of that year.
Yeah, I mean – no one's going to go back and ever think about this match, but I think there's a place for, you know, some comedic lighter fare on a match, on a show, especially following, you know, a high-intensity match like the one prior.
There was a video for the tag title match next, as Jim Ross says, let's see how this one came together. And it's revealed that this came together on Monday for the Sunday pay-per-view. It was built around Edge and Christian messing with the Undertaker's bike and luring the Dudleys to a fight in the parking lot when the Undertaker and Kane showed up to see what was happening with their bikes and led to the Dudleys and Taker and Kane fighting, and then ENC ambushed them all with chair shots to set up a tables match.
Sure.
Maybe this could have been a motorcycles on a pole match.
Okay.
Michael Cole is with the Undertaker and Kane. And he brings up the fact that they have done many things in the WWF, but they have never held tag title gold together. And The Undertaker clarifies they are not about tag titles. They are about pain and suffering, and the other teams may not survive. The titles are not their top priority.
We don't give a
take
shit.
My money, Undertaker. Thank you. What a money promo this was to get you excited. They had some shots of old Las Vegas, and then they plugged China's book, If They Only Knew, which was number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list.
Can you believe that?
If They Only Knew.
Can you believe that China was on the New York Times bestseller list?
Yeah, I mean, a testament to the popularity of the time of the character and the company. I never read that book. I was told it was horrible.
We should review it, actually.
Yeah.
It'd be a long review.
Maybe we should do a dramatic reading of it. Maybe we should pick out the best excerpts and just read it.
Great.
That could be a lot of fun.
That could.
What did you think of the Hall of Fame announcement on Monday night? You know, all this talk of China and the Hall of Fame, and the two men they announced Monday night going into the Hall of Fame, the Bushwhackers.
Okay.
Like, are you excited for that speech?
I am. Well, I don't see how the two relate.
I'm just saying that, you know, the...
Because I thought you were referring to something else.
I do have a continual chuckle whenever there is the discussion about, do you think this person should go into the WWE Hall of Fame? And I just think it's the dumbest argument ever. Like,
no, there's no real qualification.
None. You can honestly say,
Should Waylon Mercy go into the Hall? Sure. Like, anybody that they choose can go into the Hall. There is no weighing of legacy of what anyone has done. Like, the Bushwhackers will be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, the Bushwhackers are at least, you know, somewhat remembered. But you're right. Everybody's remembered, you know. Like,
I don't want any more big discussions of who should be going into the Hall of Fame. If you don't understand the thought process by now, I don't know what to tell you.
Uh-huh. Okay, let me just throw a name out there. What about Earthquake?
Of course.
Okay, what about...
John Tenta, at the very least, was the key promoted match for SummerSlam 1990 with Hogan did a good number on pay-per-view. The Bushwhackers never drew anything on pay-per-view.
Hillbilly Jim in the Hall of Fame?
I believe so. Yeah. Yeah,
he's actually in there. How about...
Coco's in there.
Just Incredible.
He would have to go in as a group.
I gotta tell you, baby, life's been good to me. And I know that makes you happy.
Oh, God. So, not everybody. Not everybody. You know,
I think everybody could go.
I don't know about Just Incredible.
I think Brooklyn Brawler will go in one day.
Okay, that I could see because of his backstage. You know, okay. But
that's what you're weighing.
Yeah,
his connection to the company.
No. I'm also weighing how well known to general audience are.
There has to be some reason for them to go in. Particularly if you're a part of their history.
Usually the reason...
You're not going to pick a random journeyman that worked Texas. Like, Killer Tim Brooks is probably never going into the WWF Hall of Fame.
You never say never.
So.
But you're right. Like, I think it typically depends on who they want to hear from, who they want to appear at that show.
Yeah. Someone sat back and said, all right, do we want to hear from Luke and Butch or the Widow of Luthez? Get the sardines ready. So that is the WWF Hall of Fame. We continue onwards with Edge and Christian defending... Oh, sorry, the Dudley Boys defending the tag titles against Edge and Christian and The Undertaker and Kane. Tables match for the tag titles. I will give credit to Jim Ross. He made it abundantly clear. First body that is put through a table, that team wins. It's one person through a table, the match is over. There's no confusion.
Sometimes
these tag title tables matches could be very confusing because they had to be both bodies going consecutively through tables. And it was a mindfuck.
Mm.
Anyway... Keep it simple, stupid was the order of the day for this match. They started on the ramp with all six fighting. The fashion sense of these six here. We had The Undertaker wearing spandex pants with a sleeveless spandex top. Kane was wearing a black outfit, and in place of his red flames were flames that were see-through. So his skin made up the flames
on his outfit. This costume, while it looked cool, was also the dumbest for the character because he's supposed to be hiding burns. And why would you give a guy hiding burns that cut but also a see-through top?
You got arms like that, way. Burns are second priority.
I suppose he had to do the red carpet with his see-through sequin flame.
Shout out to Joe Weider. Then we had Christian, who wore... This was a time where he wore this sleeveless, see-through shirt, and he had neon green tights. I always hated that top.
They're supposed to look obnoxious. You know, him with his glasses.
I guess.
Yeah.
And the Dudleys, in their camouflage, may have been
the best dressed of them all.
Okay. The old-school camo look. The Dudleys...
We should do this, like, type of a fashion critique. Like
we should have WH on, everyone. Every week, he should be like our Joan Rivers.
Is he big on the clothing?
Oh, dude, he rips guys apart for their ring attire if it sucks. Like, okay. Tetsuya Naito just takes a beating. His hair, his outfit. I mean, I love listening to WH break down guys' looks and what they wear. I think there is nothing more entertaining than WH just slamming and shaming a man for what he wears to project a star or a dud. It's great stuff. Japanese audio wrestling, folks. Edge and Christian are in control. Bubba is put in the Tree of Woe, where Edge and Christian get onto the ropes and stand on his balls. There's a big flapjack delivered to Devon. Bubba ducks a concerto and then slingshots Edge, who is holding the chair, into Christian. They deliver the was up spot to Edge. They call for the tables, but Kane and Taker attack Devon on the floor and then take advantage of Edge and Christian in the ring. Both go to the top. Undertaker and Kane and hit flying clotheslines to them. Then a table is set up, but the Undertaker stops the Dudleys from putting Christian through it with a 3D. Edge stops Taker from chokeslamming Christian through the table. There's a pair of double chokeslams to Edge and Christian. Then they do the same to the Dudleys. Then they set up for double power bombs when the forgotten tag team of Rikishi and Haku run in and attack the Undertaker and Kane and fight to the floor. This was the original WrestleMania direction for the Undertaker. Undertaker and Kane wow. against Rikishi and Haku.
Oh, my God.
Because at this point, they were hopeful of having the Shawn Michaels return at this WrestleMania with Triple H, and that would fall through. The Undertaker would end up getting Triple H a bit of a better spot at WrestleMania.
They were hoping for Shawn, like, after this pay-per-view?
Yes, for WrestleMania, okay. So like with Triple H.
Like just a one-month build for Shawn.
Yeah, going into WrestleMania. I mean, it made sense. Texas, it's a big event, and they thought Shawn would be ready. He was not ready to be coming back. But this was right after Haku had done the return at the Royal Rumble, where he was the WCW Hardcore Champion, but didn't have a contract, came back to the WWF, and he would hang around as an underneath guy for a bit in 2001,
Hall of Fame.
2002. Of course.
Haku?
Maybe Rikishi's going to insist that he join the Usos to induct him.
Oh, dude, I don't know about Haku, man. In the Hall of Fame.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Former King. King Haku.
So did you finish with the match?
No. Edge missed a spear to Bubba and then is run into a table in the corner, and Edge doesn't break the table. And then Edge gets sent to the floor, and they deliver a 3D to Christian through the table as Taker and Kane are distracted with Rikishi and Haku, and the Dudleys retain the titles 12 minutes, 4 seconds, and Taker just looks pissed as Ross says he would not want to be Rikishi and Haku.
I didn't think this was a bad match, but... You know, you compare it to the other tag matches that the Dudleys and Edge and Christian were having at this time, and this just felt like a very far distant, way at the bottom. I really felt like this Kane and Taker team didn't really belong in the same style of match as the other two teams. You know, they couldn't work the style, and there were characters that were simply not allowed to show enough vulnerability. And... You know, whatever. I think that could be kind of cool, but I think you're in the midst of an era with these three teams where the style was just too different and they didn't fit.
Yeah, it felt like their involvement was more or less to kind of splinter them off with Haku and Rikishi, and the way everything would turn out with Shawn not coming back, they'd put Kane into a hardcore title match at WrestleMania, and Rikishi and Haku, unfortunately, would be told, well, you can come to Access or... Yeah, they would be the ones going to the washroom and have to answer to a child asking, "What match are you in tonight, Kofi?"
Did Too Cool not do something? Oh, he wasn't a part of Too Cool. Never mind.
No, not at this point.
Yeah, but of course this led to Triple H and Taker, which was a classic match as well.
Yep. And then we had another WrestleMania promo. Worth noting in these promos that it was all current stars featured in the promo, with the exception of Shawn Michaels, who had two separate sequences in this 30-second promo. So that was the thought process at the time, was Shawn would be able to come back for WrestleMania. Then they show a video for the main event with Rock beating Big Show to get the title match and presenting Kurt as a bit more serious. And also this was the time that they were introducing the sharpshooter as a submission move for the Rock, who just a dreadful, pardon the pun, execution, which was far from excellent of that sharpshooter, but trying to give him something other than just the Rock Bottom and, I guess, to a degree, the People's Elbow as viable finishes for him.
I'm just amazed that, you know, like, didn't he do it recently, too, at one of the Cena matches? Didn't he try to pull it off? Like, I'm just amazed that, like, whatever, even up until this point in 2001, that nobody stopped him to tell him, hey, cross the legs this way, or, you know, this is how you do it properly. Like, there's just... The time and time again, I suppose you could call it his own style.
It was the loose shooter.
what's the opposite of sharp? blunt or dull, the dull shooter.
That was about as as smooth as Michael Cole was all night long with his blonde tips as he interviews The Rock, who throughout all the promos leading up to this would include the words TikTok, TikTok. And he said, TikTok, Kurt Angle, the countdown and your reign as champion is over. As he would proceed to come out for the main event, big reaction for The Rock. And Kurt Angle comes out, there's a big stare down. And the job of Jim Ross and Taz at the start of this match was basically to tell everyone, all right, we know that you know we're not headlining WrestleMania in a stadium with Kurt Angle. We know you know it's Rock and Austin, but we are going to do our damnedest to make you believe that it is not a foregone conclusion that Kurt Angle is essentially holding this championship for The Rock, and tonight is his night to hand it over to the real guy that is going to be headlining WrestleMania. And that was the goal of this match by the announce team.
Yeah, makes sense.
They teased the ankle lock early with Rock grabbing the rope. Angle hits a pair of belly-to-belly suplexes, and then Rock hits one of his own and then goes for the sharpshooter, and immediately there's a rope break by Angle. Rock gets sent to the floor and starts selling the left knee. He comes back with a DDT. And then the Big Show's music plays. Big Show comes down, enters the ring, chokeslams referee Mike Chioda, chokeslams Kurt Angle, chokeslams The Rock. The busy production, the sound engineer, has to play the music again for his exit, and Big Show just walks to the back. Don't know why this needed to be in here, in this main event match.
What happened with this?
I can't remember anything other than probably a TV match, maybe, at most.
Okay.
Maybe the idea was... I have no idea what the involvement was. This was at a time when the Big Show was... I mean, he was just almost being written off at this point. There was a time in 2000 where... I mean, he was sent down to OVW. Mm-hmm. This was after headlining WrestleMania the year before, and he was sent down to OVW. And then... he was told to lose weight. He didn't really lose weight. And then they brought him back at the Royal Rumble because they were like, listen, we're paying this guy a lot of money to wrestle in Louisville. Mm. Bring him back up. And it was just trying to find stuff for this guy. And this was not a great period for the Big Show. He would grow into a fine performer.
Yeah.
But I didn't really see it at this point with him. He was just really just another guy in that main event mix. I thought Ross summed it up perfectly as Big Show was walking to the back and Ross just asks, what the hell? And that's what everyone was asking. Angle gets on top and Earl Hebner is in to count two. Then Rock hits Angle with the belt shot as Hebner is tending to Mike Chioda, comes back and Rock gets a near fall. Angle recovers, he gets the ankle lock, and he is screaming at the Rock to tap, drives his knee into the mat repeatedly, reapplies it, was even censored here in what he was yelling at The Rock. This was the version of Kurt Angle, and I always remembered this pay-per-view. It was the first time you saw the killer Kurt Angle. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, it's finally time we ditch all this comedy. This run as champion, it didn't really change that tone with Kurt Angle. And I thought, okay, he's losing the title, but at least you're getting Kurt Angle into another light. Mm-hmm. And that was the hope. And unfortunately, it really wouldn't sustain afterwards. But this was kind of the direction of the match. Rock got up, he hit a spinebuster, a people's elbow, great near fall as the crowd erupts, and just boos afterwards, and chants of bullshit when The Rock did not get the pinfall. And
that was very strange.
Yeah.
I think somebody screwed something up. What happened here?
I think you're talking about later where the screw-up
finish
happened. But Angle would block a Rock bottom, drives him into the exposed turnbuckle, which Kurt had removed, and then hits an Angle slam and only gets a two count. Big pop as Rock kicks out. Then Rock goes to punch him in the corner, goes for that deal where he spits in his hand and gets kicked in the ankle as he does so, and then runs at The Rock, and Angle gets sent into the exposed turnbuckle with his momentum. A Rock bottom is hit, and Earl Hebner goes to count three, and Angle's shoulders are down, but Hebner doesn't count three, and it totally took some of the air out of the balloon where this was supposed to be the finish. I don't know if it was Angle forgetting that they were supposed to maybe do two Rock bottoms, because that was Rock just hit a second Rock bottom, got the pinfall. And they were really hitting on the fact that it took two Rock bottoms to beat Kurt Angle. I could very much see that being the original plan, and Earl Hebner was aware of that. and maybe Curtain Rock forgot about that. I don't know who screwed up, but it was a mess up.
Yeah, something happened to basically kind of deflate the reaction, unfortunately. And Rock looked pissed after this.
I would have been too. It's like you build and build, and then the big spot is a fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the crowd didn't seem to care. They just they wanted to see Rock win the title. He did. And Ross says, now we can start the countdown to Rock and Austin at WrestleMania. And Ross puts over Kurt Angle. And Ross was so great at this, of a guy that even in defeat, he would always protect them and try to make them come across as, you know, protected, mm-hmm. even after a loss. And Kurt starts crying on the ramp, and Taz is pointing this out, like, look at this baby. He's crying. And I just found it amusing because we had the exact same sell from Okada at Wrestle Kingdom, and that was played up as this monumental defeat to Okada. And I just thought Jim Ross did a great sell job here at the end, making WrestleMania feel like the biggest show ever coming up in April.
Mm-hmm.
And that ended the show.
I thought the match was very good. Definitely, though, second from the intensity and drama of Austin versus Triple H, but on a card where you have two very good matches, very strong matches like this, overall I'd say it was a pretty good show.
Yeah, I give this show an 8 out of 10, largely off of the 2 out of 3 falls match, and I thought Trish and Stephanie really over-delivered in their match of what people expected. Main event was good. I don't know if it was the best Rock and Kurt Angle match, but I always found those two to have very good chemistry together. Four-way was good. I mean, very little to complain about on this show, mm-hmm. and really set the main title picture in place for WrestleMania. You knew your main event coming out of this show if you had bought it.
Yeah, I also give it an 8. Sounds good.
All right. Do you want me to tackle feedback on my own?
I can do it.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to go over to the Law message board and see what you had to say about it. Alan writes, the February show always gets overlooked. I guess people aren't expecting much, thinking the creative and performers will hold back and save the good stuff for WrestleMania. However, more often than not, the show over-delivers, and this might be my favorite February pay-per-view they ever put together. The Angle Rock match was the best one they ever had with each other, despite the screw-up at the end. The Three Stages of Hell is a classic. The rest of the card was filled with fun matches as well, particularly the four-way, and even Trish against Stephanie. No one was expecting much from that match, as Trish was still about 6 months away from being a credible competitor. She was pretty much on Stephanie's level at this point, but the match worked. I would agree.
We go to Matt in suburban Detroit. After reliving this pay-per-view, WWE buying WCW was a great change to the potential post-Mania plans. I'm glad there isn't any more hardcore matches. This was just bad. Four-way was good despite X-Pac. Not even an X-Factor Uncle Cracker theme can save him. Three Stages of Hell was good, but not as good as the hype. My favorite part of this pay-per-view was that Jerry Lawler and the Cat left the WWE after this, and we would get the great Paul Heyman on commentary.
Okay, we go to Aram from Denmark. I like the pay-per-view a lot. The four-way match, Three Stages of Hell, and the Rock Angle match. But why did they drop Angle off of the main event for WrestleMania? Was the plan always for Rock Austin? Yeah, that was always the plan for WrestleMania. I know that was the big money match, but still, I felt it hurt Angle a lot with the loss. I also remember the women's match being quite good for what it was. 8 dealing with the X factors out of 10. I thought it was always premature to put the title on Angle when they did in 2000, where he was very much a transitional champion. And I think it would have been, I think you could have built to that first title match a lot more when Angle was, I just think his in-ring was incredible in 2001, but the creative and character switches in 2001 were, I mean, I think he was a real victim of constant changes and a lot of comedy that he was great at, but I think he outgrew needing that comedy.
We go to Dwayne in Ireland. This show happened at pretty much the height of my fandom in wrestling, and the feud between Triple H and Austin with a no physical contact stipulation in the lead up to the pay-per-view was tremendous, as was the prospect of Three Stages of Hell. The match is still a great spectacle, but it's not quite as good as I remembered at the time. Stephanie and Trish had a fun catfight that was much better than it had any right to be, and despite the botched count at the end, Rock and Angle had a great match too, though the Big Show run-in was completely unnecessary.
Okay, next up we have Christian Small.
outside of the opening match, which was everything I hated about the hardcore title, I really liked this show. The four-way IC title match was great, and while X-Pac gets a lot of heat, there's no denying that he's a fantastic worker, and he was in there with three of the best ever, so of course it was great. Trish and Stephanie wasn't a masterpiece, but the fans ate it up and was really heated because of it. It could have been way worse. I thought the Three Stages of Hell match was a little long, but it made sense, as it felt like three separate matches by the end. It was also done really well. I especially liked the story of the obvious winner of one match type losing, an example with Austin. Losing the street fight and the finish was well done, putting over Hunter while keeping Austin strong. For some reason, I thought this closed the show. It was probably wise to put it on so early. Rock and Angle had a really good match despite the show run-in and the botched three count at the end. I also loved the moment Earl dropped the other referee to go make a three count. I give this show an 8 out of 10.
We go to Brad McKinnon from Halifax, who says, everyone was over. It's incredible to hear the crowd just explode for any of these characters and some very memorable gimmicks. How far has the Big Show fallen at this point from being a secret weapon to a guy in a crazy plunder match in 2 years? Every match on this pay-per-view had some sort of stake attached to it, which made them all feel special rather than just another rematch.
Ronaldo from Italy, a really, really good show that gave us two great main events, especially the Three Stages of Hell, the best of its genre since its inception, with no disrespect to the guys from the backyard and their three fans in the middle of the desert. Back in the day, the newsletters kind of criticized Triple H for stealing a win over Hunter, who was poised to get the title at WrestleMania, but working-wise, it was the best direction since the two were faced to have a program with each other, with Triple H as the face, and this was the seed on which to build the whole thing. Too bad it never materialized. Big Show was meaningless then and more so now.
Brian from Pennsylvania. Trish and Steph had a decent little catfight, and I honestly forgot what Stephanie looked like before her chest expanded. Austin and Triple H felt long to me, and by the time they got to the cage match, it burned me out, but it was still a great match. Did you catch the beer can that hit Austin on the head? He's talked about it on several of his shows. I noticed something when the two of them were lying down, and some asshole in the crowd threw a can at both men.
Yeah, I remember when I was watching this in my head, I remembered some fan throwing something when I first watched this pay-per-view, and I couldn't remember who got hit.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if it was on the network version because I was watching for it and didn't see it.
But I noticed.
Yeah, that would have been it
after the pinfall at the very end. Somebody threw something. It kind of shook him as it should.
And
it would have.
Yeah, Mike from Huntsville writes, great pick for this week. It was very exciting being a young fan at this time. For me, it was all about the three top competitors, Austin, Rock, and Triple H. All three dressed pretty much the same when they were wrestling and were the same sort of size, but they had different in-ring styles and massively different characters. Most importantly, they all wanted the title and would do anything to get it. My favorite was always Triple H, whether heel or babyface. Overall, the show was pretty good, mostly due to the crowd. I loved the intensity of Austin and Triple H. Putski candidates for me were Triple H and Hardcore Holly, and also Mr. McMahon's back during that massage segment. 7 denim vests out of 10.
Oh my. Are you going to pick one?
Let's go with Vince's back, because it got the biggest laugh.
A lot of body parts.
Well, we got to isolate, Wade. Maybe that's the way
I also feel like we're like forcing some winners.
Sometimes it needs to be organic.
Yeah.
But this was a pay-per-view where, you had some looks at this time in the WWF.
Like it. Finally, Alan from England via Japan.
With a nice photo at Ribera Steakhouse.
Oh, wow.
Look at that.
As with the previous writer, reviewer, this was also the height of my WWF fandom, and I could remember a great deal of this show, even though this was the first time I've watched it in 14 years. I love the 24/7 rule as a high schooler, but nowadays the concept was a mess. Why would you organize a straight one-on-one match when people can run in as whenever they wanted to? It just seemed a way to keep guys that had no direction busy. Billy Gunn in the hardcore division. I enjoyed the IC match, even though X-Pac was seemingly only there to eat the pin. And the women's match was fine, though I can never truly enjoy any match which involves a McMahon wrestling. The sole problem was the booking for the Three Stages of Hell. Why did Triple H have to go over here? It was the culmination of the Survivor Series 99 hit-and-run angle, which they surely should point to the babyface's ultimate redemption, and Austin was going to win the title at the next pay-per-view, so he should have won to maintain his momentum, not lose clean to his rival of the past months.
I disagree. I think I thought the booking of this that night was completely sound to give Austin a perfect direction after WrestleMania. He's got a guy that owns a win over the champion. I thought it was sound booking. The problem was they didn't execute the turn with Triple H afterwards, and they teased it the night after WrestleMania where he storms the ring with the cage set up, and instead of, the fans were ready to get behind Hunter that night. They thought that's where they were going, and instead he joined with Austin, and it was lost. And no, I don't think anyone had any interest in these two teaming together, and business very much reflected that as well. So that was No Way Out. Thank you to all of you for your feedback on this show. Wei Ting, like a speeding bullet, you need a you have a train to catch.
Back to...
That's right. That is right. You have already gone there. Now you are coming back. It's a beautiful Skype connection, I've got to say. The best we have ever had today.
Yes.
Next week, I have done the math, Mr. Ting. We have 4 shows before WrestleMania. So this year, do we want to do our idea where we do the Raw WrestleMania combo?
Yeah.
I love doing those. I really like the go-home show right before WrestleMania. We have a few requests for WrestleManias. We have some early era WrestleManias in terms of...
Is there one with Savage that we haven't done?
Yes. In fact, we have... Well, the WrestleMania 3 and 6 have both been requested.
We haven't done WrestleMania 3?
No, we haven't. And that was the big Savage Steamboat one.
Okay, maybe we save that one.
Okay.
For later.
We can do that later. I think with the earlier ones, they always had the big Saturday night's main event right before WrestleMania that we could always do. So we have 3 and 6. And then more modern ones are 23 and 24, which have been requested. 23 being... Cena and Shawn Michaels, as well as the Donald Trump year, and then 24 being the Flair retirement and Floyd Mayweather.
Let's do that one.
The Floyd one?
Yeah.
He's in the news right now.
I want to actually watch that Flair match again.
Yeah, that would be great. And there is an awesome segment on the Raw going into WrestleMania with Ric Flair. So
sweet.
Next week we'll review the March 24th 2008
you sure?
edition of sure. Monday Night Raw.
March 24th. Let me look at that.
And it's a 2-hour Raw, so I'm extra excited to watch this. We will try and find that episode of Raw to post so everyone can see it. I know some of these Raws are tough to find.
Did you say 2004?
2008.
2008. Oh,
okay. So March 24th, if I'm not mistaken. So the Raw, and then in 2 weeks' time, we will review WrestleMania 24, which has Edge and The Undertaker with Jimmy Corderas refereeing that main event of WrestleMania that year. Floyd Mayweather and Big Show, and as Wei mentioned, Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels in one of Ric Flair's final wrestling matches. So that'll be our first WrestleMania review for WrestleMania season.
March 24th, you're right.
That will be all for us. We're going to get on out of here. Much like last week, we're going to end with some Jim Ross. And Jim Ross, after The Rock wins the title, selling you on WrestleMania 17, where you had no option but to buy that pay-per-view at the demand of Jim Ross.
And now we can start counting the days. We can start building the anticipation for Sunday, April the 1st, in the Astrodome, the crowd at WrestleMania 17. The Rock will defend the WWF title against Stone Cold Steve Austin. A night of broken bones and bloodbaths. A night of rivalries ending and beginning. And a night for The Rock has become the WWF champion. And now The Rock will move on to WrestleMania. Can you imagine the scene? 60,000 and plus in the Astrodome to see The Rock in Stone Cold for the WWF title. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us from Las Vegas. Good night, everybody.